So we're on Kuf Yud Beis Amud Beis. We finished actually two lines before the end of the daf. So we'll just sort of summarize the last member of Ravina, which we did. When was the last time we got together? Who remembers? I don't remember.
I think it was the
Yom Shiur
on Tuesday.
Tuesday was Erev Yom Tov. No, so it was last Thursday, just a week ago.
No, it wasn't.
So we had a statement about the Shliach Beis Din. An interesting question that the Gemara raises: what's the status of a Shliach Beis Din? Does he have the status of two Eidim? And the difference is going to be whether or not we can assume, as the Shliach Beis Din claims, that he gave over the word to the Nidon, right, to the Nitba, and he actually invited or summoned the Nitba into court. And Ravina initially said that yes, we can trust the Shliach Beis Din as if he were two Eidim. And if the Nidon says, I never got the message, and he's contradicted by the Shliach Beis Din, we don't believe the Nitba, we believe the Shliach Beis Din. However, the Gemara then says that sometimes it's relevant to Dine Momenos. And that's because there's a halacha called schar sofer. Schar sofer means, here comes it, means that when somebody causes Beis Din, he's responsible for Beis Din making a decision to write up a document. The document has to be written by a sofer, and the sofer can demand his payment, his wages for that. In the case, for example, of what's called the shtar psicha that we've been discussing, which means to write a nidui and put a whammy on someone because he refuses to show up in Beis Din, he's a sarvan. So in that case, if the nidon, the nitba, refuses to come to Beis Din, even though he got a clear-cut invitation to Beis Din, he was summoned into court, then a shtar psicha has to be written up. And this is all based on the testimony of one Jew, namely the shliach Beis Din. He claims that he notified the defendant that he has to come forward and show up in Beis Din. The Nidon, from his point, the defendant claims, I never got the message. And now if we rely on the credibility of the Shliach Beis Din, we're going to write up a Shtar Psicha, which means that we're going to have to bill the defendant to pay Schar Sofer. So in such a case, the Torah says, "Al pishnayim eidim yakum dofer," that the minimum amount of witnesses necessary to force someone to pay, right, which means lahotzi mamim mechazkaso, is two witnesses. So even though we do, as a rule, we trust the shliach Beis Din against the nidon, but that's only if we're trying to determine facts and figures. But the very moment we go beyond that and we want to force the defendant to shell out money, then it takes on a whole new category, and it's motzi momen mechazkaso. For that we need two eidim. So the status of the shliach Beis Din is this, what I call this intermittent bein hashmashos. You know, it's neither here nor there. He's not fully like two eidim, but he's believed more than just one witness. So in a battle between, you know, a contradiction between the Shliach Beis Din and the Nidon, the Shliach Beis Din is believed. But if it comes, your push comes to shove, and now we want the Nidon to pay money, pay out of pocket, for that we need two Eidim. And the status of the Shliach Beis Din, with all due respect, is not the same as two Eidim. So that's just a quick review of the last thing we discussed a week ago. And now we start something new. The statement now that we want to study Ravina, which is two lines before the end of the Amud, is once having established that the Shliach Beis Din has credibility and we give him a special status, we want to know if that could apply to someone who normally doesn't have credibility in monetary cases. For whatever reason, that person has what's called a psul haguf. And a psul haguf means that they're technically excluded from testimony. So the Gemara wants to know, if we're going to have to rely on the testimony of the Shliach Beis Din, then who could serve as a Shliach Beis Din? Can anyone serve as a Shliach Beis Din? Even someone who really does not come into Beis Din in order to testify? And not only that, it's a little bit odd, because if we're relying on the Shliach Beis Din to deliver the message to the defendant that he's been summoned to court, well, there may be situations in which the Shliach Beis Din, see, he didn't get some sort of formal appointment, that he may not take this seriously. How do we know that he understood that under all circumstances he must fulfill his shlichus, his agency, and deliver the message to the defendant? So the first question that Ravina wants to address is the case of an isha. What's the status of a woman? Can she be appointed as a shliach beis din? And the reason for the question is because, as we said before, since Shliach Beis Din is elevated to the status of an aide, of a witness in Dini Mamonos, well, a woman is not accepted as an aide. Again, that's called a psula guf. There are many cases in Shas, I'll just point out on the side, where a woman is believed. But that's only because we're talking about Nemanus, not of aidim, but we're talking about a special kind of credibility where there's no technical psula guf. Comes along Ravina and he says a Shliach Beis Din doesn't require someone who has the full-fledged status of an aide with all the kashrus of an aide. El afilu, I added the word afilu here, afuma de isisa, even on the say-so of a woman who is sent by Beis Din to deliver the message, her credibility is enough. We don't need Toras Edus. All we need is Toras Ne'emanus. We need credibility, and she has credibility. The second question Ravina wants to address is, what about neighbors? Neighbors are not actually called into Beis Din in any sense with a formal agent, you know, a formal appointment. There was no appointment on the part of Beis Din, but rather the word got out through the neighborhood that Beis Din is looking for this guy. And is that enough? Can we rely on the neighbors who will see this person when, let's say, for example, the person is out of the city, right? They're not in town. So in that case, Beis Din is not going to be able to summon that person into court unless they tell the neighbors, please be sure that when this person returns from outside the city into the inside of the city, comes back home, you're the neighbors, you'll know about it, let him know. Says Ravina, here too we can rely on this expanded definition of a shliach beis din, afuma d'shivave. We can even rely on the neighbors, that the neighbors will deliver the message to the Nidon, right, to the accused, that he was summoned into Beis Din. Again, it may take a while till they're able to transmit that message, because they have to wait until such time as the defendant returns from his long trip and he comes home. But nevertheless, we're not going to assume that the shivave, that the neighbors will be laid back about it. They realize and they appreciate the severity of the issue. And as soon as he comes back into the city, we can rely that they will fulfill their mission and transmit the message. However, at this point, the Ravina says, wait a minute, this has to be limited. He says, V'lo amaron, when do we assume that you can appoint a woman or a neighbor and assume that they will certainly deliver the message when they understand full well how critical it is that they convey this and transmit this summons to Beis Din? And that's only El Delesa B'masa, when he's outside the city. Then they understand very well the weight of responsibility that weighs on their shoulders. Here we're going on to Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. Avol Ise B'masa, but if he's located in the city, lo, in such a case, Beis Din becomes responsible to personally summon him into Beis Din. They can't rely on these, you know, borderline, shall we say, questionable shluchim, messengers or agents, because the Amrinon, we have to worry about the following possibility. Amar lo amrule. we have to raise the possibility that these are not reliable shluchim, that they will not in fact fulfill their agency. Why? The Amri, because they come to the conclusion that since he, the defendant, is where? He's in the city. They think, therefore, Ashkechinu Shlicha de Beidina, then a formal appointment of what's called the Shlicha de Beisdin, because you know every Beisdin has a person who's employed by the Beisdin as the stand-up Shliach Beisdin. You know, whenever Beisdin has to get a message to the defendant, they always send this certain person. Every Beisdin has its own built-in Shliach Beisdin. You shouldn't know from it, but if you ever have to show up in a Beisdin, especially here in Israel, it's common that people have to show up for a get, you know, for a divorce. You'll always see that there's a Shliach Beisdin that's appointed. We call it Yiddish Upstandigen. You know, he's always there. You know, he's reliable, and he gets a salary for that because we're going to rely on him to fulfill his responsibility and deliver the message, summon someone to court. But here we're talking about someone who's not employed by Beis Din. He's not the official appointee of Beis Din. Certainly, this woman is not appointed by Beis Din, and not even the neighbors. And therefore, they're going to come to their own conclusions based on all their psychological factors and they'll weigh in different considerations. They're going to think, well, if he's in the city, they don't really need me to fulfill this. They'll find the Shliach Beis Din that's, you know, employed and he has a 9-to-5 job. He works there 6 days a week. In Chutz Laretz, 5 days a week. And Ashkechinu Shlicha de Beis Din of Yomrele. And they are very laid back about it. They won't take it very seriously. They don't feel the weight of responsibility on their shoulders because they're relying on the fact that Beis Din will finally send the Shliach. But if, on the other hand, this is Ravina's original statement, where is the defendant? Outside the city limits, then these quasi, how should I say, replacement Shluchei Beis Din that weren't appointed on a permanent basis, they will understand and appreciate the severity and the responsibility that's on their shoulders, that as soon as this individual who's being summoned to court shows up in the city limits, they will deliver the message. Here's another limitation rule, says Ravina. V'lo amaran el delo chalif abava de Beis Din. Suppose you have an individual who might be far away, but nevertheless, at some point, he passes. Let's say the Beis Din is a major, it's a major citadel. You know, it's like the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. If anyone knows London, right? So it's impossible that he would not go through that major artery in the city, and he would pass on the very footsteps of Beis Din. In such a case, Aval Chalif Abava de Beis Din, we know that this individual cannot avoid showing up at the threshold or the portal of Beis Din. Lo, in such case again, they, this Isha or this Shachain, who's not very official, not an official appointee, is not going to take it seriously enough. Amri, they'll say to themselves, justifying psychologically, Ashkechu Beis Din V'Amrile, the Beis Din themselves will find him when he passes by, and they will call him in and certainly deliver the summons. Now he has a third limitation. Lo Amarna El De'asi B'Yome. This only applies to someone who, even if he's outside the city limits, but he generally comes back into the city during the daylight hours. But if he doesn't appear during the daylight hours, he only comes at night to sleep in his house, and then the very next morning with daybreak he takes the first train out and he's already gone from the city. Lo, once again, we won't rely on these people who are not officially appointed. Why? Ema, because we have to worry about the fact of ishtaluye ishtale. You know what? They may have put it in the back of their minds. Day after day passes by, they never encountered this individual, this defendant, and they didn't transmit the summons. And over the course of time, they're going to forget about this responsibility. So let's just summarize. We have two statements here of Ravina. The first statement is that a Shliach Beis Din is a very weighty responsibility to the extent that we believe him, that he delivered the message, he fulfilled his agency, even against the word of the defendant. The second statement of Ravina is that even if someone is not officially appointed as the stand-up paid shaliach beis din, we can still expand the scope of who can serve as a shliach beis din to include a woman who's not normally kosher liedus, to include shivavei who might take this in a laid back way. No, they understand the weight of their responsibility, and we can rely on them as we do in any shliach, that the shliach will be makayim and fulfill his shliach. However, Ravina in his second statement curtails this, and he says that if there are different psychological factors in which, given that reality, the shliach who's not a real shliach is going to justify the fact that we can put it out of our minds, we can rely on this, that, or the other thing, we might even forget about it over the course of time. In such a case, we should not appoint these quasi-shluchim as shluchim. Amar Rava. Now we get a statement of Rava. Now, with regard to a defendant who refuses the summons, we have two different categories, or two different cases. And the Gemara is going to make a distinction between the two. The first case is Haiman deksiv alayu psicha, is a person who was placed into nidui through this document that, you know, puts a whammy on him, and he, as we said last week, he can't become part of a minion, he can't be counted as a minion. It's all shaila about whether we circumcise his son, if you recall. So in such a person who refuses to show up in Beis Din, and we put him into nidui, and let's say he sends a message to Beis Din that, you know what, I'll show up, but he hasn't yet shown up. Is adalo asi ledina, until he actually physically shows up in the walls of the courtroom, is adalo asi ledina, is we will not rip up this shtar, we will not terminate the nidui. Adi asi ledina, we're not going to rip it up and destroy it. Why? Because even though he has made a declaration and the word got back to Beis Din that he has agreed in principle to show up in Beis Din, we don't trust him. Because this was a very far-reaching need. You know, it was applied to a person who very rebelliously defied the courts, and in contempt of court he decided he's not going to show up. Now he says, all right, I'm doing tshuva. You know, I will show up. No, that's not enough. The nidui is because you didn't show up in Beis Din, and the breaking, the termination of the nidui is only going to be relevant when you do show up in Beis Din. Okay, now we get to a different case. Adelo tzayis ledine. What about a person who was willing to show up in Beis Din, but they wrote him a shtar psicha, a nidui, for a different reason? Because he refuses to pay up, meaning that Beis Din had issued a final verdict that we'll call him Shimon. Shimon has to pay Reuven, and Shimon refuses to pay Reuven. So Rava, in his original formulation, the Gemara is going to reject this, goes very far. He says even in this case, it's not enough that he, Shimon, the defendant, makes a statement, I'm willing to pay up, I'm just looking for the funds, I'm gathering, you know, liquidating assets. No, we're going to continue with the shtar nidui, we're going to continue his excommunication, so to speak, aditzayis, until he actually pays up. Loma karinale, we will not rip up this psicha, this shtar nidui. It's not sufficient that he makes the claim that I'm willing to pay. And here I would press the return button, because now the Gemara is going to accept Rava in part, but reject Rava in part. And the Gemara is going to accept Rava that if you're talking about a person who is refusing to show up in Beis Din, that is a very severe rebellion against the court, a contempt of court, and we can accept Rava that he's got to show up in Beis Din until finally we can rescind and terminate the shtar nidui. However, in the second case, where he's willing to show up in Beis Din, but he hasn't yet fulfilled the edict, the decision of Beis Din to pay and write out the check, that's a little different. Kevan diomar tzaisina, once he accepted upon himself the psak din, he accepted the final verdict of Beis Din, and he says, I'm willing to pay up, karinale. At that point, we can terminate the nidui, And that's not like a rebellious person who refuses to show up in Beis Din. I mean, he's not such a mechutzav. He's not such a bal chutzpah. He's willing to show up in Beis Din. He just needs time to gather his funds together in order to actually pay up. You know, imagine an expensive lawsuit. You know, he was sued for $500,000. You know, it takes him a while. He's got to sell this and sell that. In such a case, as long as he declares, I'm willing to pay, I accept the psak bez, then he's not rebellious, he just needs an extension of time. In such a case, the moment he makes that declaration, we could rip up the shtar nid. Here I wanted to add that the Shita Mekubetzes, which is the super commentary on Masechta Bava Kama, adds a comment in the name of the Yad Rama, one of the Sephardic Rishonim. And he says that, you know what, Beis Din is going to issue a verdict that he has to pay up. And they will decide how much time they want to give him to liquidate assets and fulfill and implement that psak. If that time elapses and they issue another edict against him that now you have to pay, and again he refuses to pay, in such a case, even the maskana of the Gemara is like Rava, we will not rescind the shtar nidu. It's only if he made that declaration, I'm willing to pay, after the first summons that said to him he has to pay. But if he becomes a habitual sinner, so to speak, you know, it's Beis Din gave him what they thought was a reasonable amount of time to gather together the funds, and once again he says to Beis Din, I'm not able to pay, that already is crossing all the red lines. So it means that we do accept Rava in the full sense, but we have to add one condition, that in the case of a person who says, I'm willing to pay, we're not going to continue the nidui, maintain the nidui, as long as we have reason to think that he's not chutzpahdik. But as if on the second round, once again, we demand that he pay, and he still says, I can't pay, that already crosses all red lines. And even Lamaskana, even the Lohi, we still accept Rava, that in such a case we continue the need. Now, how much time can we give a person to refuse to show up in Beis Din until we finally put him into Nidui? So you may remember that there was a statement that we learned about a week ago on Daf Kuf Yud Beis, Amud Beis, the previous Amud in the name of Rava, that we give him what's called Beis Hei Beis. We'll summon him to Beis Din on Monday, and then on Thursday, and the following Monday, and if on three times he refuses to show up in Beis Din, then we'll put this whammy on him. Amar Rav Chisda, now let's understand Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda raises the following Lamdash HaKira. He wants to know the following. What happens with Beis Hei Beis? How do you define that rebellion against Beis Din, that contempt of court? Is it that Beis Din will warn him from the get-go on the first Monday that will give you up to Thursday and even up till the next Monday, and basically we combine three warnings into one, or no? Every single occasion that's Beis and then Hey and then Beis requires its own warning. So that's where Rav Chisda says, Kovin Zman Sheni. On Monday, we decide that he's going to have to come into Beis Din, and we give him the summons. Chamishi, a few days later, 3 days later on Thursday, we again issue a second summons. And then Sheni, on the following Monday, we issue a third summons. So basically, this man has been warned by Beis Din on three different occasions. Zimna, vizimna, basar zimna. We have to make sure that after each summons, there'll be another summons, which is called a hazmana, in which he's invited, so to speak, into Beis Din. It's not the kind of invitation you'd want to get, like for a wedding or a bar mitzvah. Here's an invitation to show up in court. Nobody likes that. People have better things to do with their time than to show up in court. But according to Rav Chisda's Chiddush here, you need Zimna, Vizimna, Basar Zimna. In other words, after each case that he refuses, there has to be another special Hazmana. And it's not sufficient that from the beginning they give him three dates. And they say, well, either show up today, or show up on Thursday, or show up the following Monday. And then Ulumachar Kasvino, and then after he refused to show up on the second Monday, which means he's violated three warnings, and he was rebellious against three summons, at that point, we write the Shtar Psicha. Now the Gemara tells a story. Rav Asi Ikla Bei Rav Kahana. Rav Asi once had an occasion to be summoned into the court of Rav Kahana. Chaza, or Chaza Lahi Issa Di Azmin Oladina Bifanya. He observed a case, I guess he was second in line, so he observed the case that came into Beis Din to Rav Kahana before his case. And in this particular scenario, a woman was summoned into Beis Din. Okay? And she refused to show up on that very day. But Safra, when day broke the next morning, Kosiv Allah, Rav Kahana mandated the court to write against her a psicha, a shtar nidui. In other words, they only gave her one occasion, and once she rebelled against that one summons, they already put her into nidui. Amar Leiser of Asi, who was again observing, because he was next on line for his judgment, he got a little nervous maybe, and he says to Rav Kahana, Lo Sovra Le Mar, do you not hold of the very famous principle of Rav Chisda? Lo Hodi Amar Rav Chisda says, Kovin's Man Sheni. First we tell her, show up, in this case a woman, show up on Monday, and then after she refused to show up, Chamishi on that Thursday again, we issue a second summons. And if she refuses again, Sheni, then the following Monday, a third summons. And here, overnight, you already zapped her with this nidui. Amalei, so Rav Kahana suggested a radical breakthrough here, that the statement of Rav Chisda, that has to be a triple violation of three summons, that's Hani Milu, that's only with regard to a Gavra. With regard to a man, and not only a man, but it's a specific type of man who fits the following description, the honest. Honest means, again I'm going to sort of dramatize it, but he's a big businessman. He's very tarud ba'asakov. Rashi explains that, you know, he can't free himself. He's up in, I don't know, Nairia, wherever he is, you know, once every couple of years, and he can't leave, right? Velesa Bamasa, he's out of the city limits. He's always on the go. He's traveling. I knew a man in Toronto. I got very close to him, Sam Nussbaum, all of a sudden. He died during the 2 years I was in Toronto, and I adored this man. He was at the age of, I think he was already close to 90, maybe he was past 90. Sam was, every other day, he was on a trip to China doing business. Like, he had the youth and the vitality of a 30-year-old, you know. And I was very sad when he passed away. So when you talk about a person who, like Sam Nussbaum, you know, is always on the move, then Aval Isisa, that applies to a man, but a woman came in the Issa B'masa, again, today it might change, but back in the day, she was always local. She wasn't going out to China on big business deals. Is Veloasia, if she didn't show up in Beis Din, there's no excuse for that. She had no problem showing up the very next day. And if she refuses to show up in Beis Din, Moretisi, she's already in contempt of court, and we should put her into Nidui. So this is going to be up Kepaskin in Shulchan Aruch, that the law of Nidui is contingent upon the fact that it's a person who's not Torud Basakov, he's not totally dedicated to his business in such a way that he's constantly traveling, and in such a case we can zap him with a Nidui immediately, but if it's a person who is Torud Basakov, then we'll give him Sheni, and then a second summons, and then Chamishi, and then Sheni. Amar Rabbi Yehuda lo yahavina zimna. There are certain periods of time in the Hebrew calendar year where we avoid presenting a summons to a person. Number one, lo biyomei Nisan, during the month of Nisan. I always wondered about the minig that we don't say Tachnun on Nisan. Maybe this is the source for it. Because if they can't get you into Bez, then that's a holiday unto itself. Velobiyome Tishrei, not during the month of Tishrei. Because during these two periods of time, these are, from an agricultural perspective, high seasons. Because during the month of Tishrei, for example, is the time of planting. During the month of Nisan is the time of harvesting, what we call Katzir Ubatzir. So these are very busy periods of time, and we should not invite a person, because if you summons a person, he can't possibly come into Bezdin. So he puts the summons in his, you know, in the back of his mind, and he forgets about it. But it's not necessarily that he's in contempt of court. These are mitigating circumstances. Not only that, says Rabbi Yehuda, lo b'mali yom tov lo mali shabbos, not an Erev Yontif or an Erev Shabbos. Now, he doesn't mention Erev Rosh Hashanah, but I assume that Erev Rosh Hashanah should certainly apply, because on Erev Rosh Hashanah we have a lot of special minhagim. You know, we have, what do they call it, Hatar Snedarim, and people go to mikvah on Erev Rosh Hashanah, some people even fast on Erev, a lot of different minhagim on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So even though technically the words Yom Tava mean Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuos, maybe there's a special chiddush in Shavuos, because on Erev Shavuos, he should not be involved in what's called Hakazas Dam. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. In those days, the, you know, when you had high blood pressure, they used to bloodlet. I don't know, I was told that somebody told me there's an article now that they're beginning to consider bringing it back into vogue. I don't know. But in any event, for us it's a little bit strange, you know, to take out blood. In Yiddish, I think it's called bankis. Did you ever hear that word? Toyin bankis. I'm not sure if it's Yiddish. It's probably Polish, but it was adopted by the Yiddish language. You'll tell me, David, next week. Bankis, just don't forget. Okay. Aval Nisan Lebasi Yemei Nisan. Oh, so here the Gemara makes a distinction. It doesn't mean that for one full month of Nisan or one full month of Tishrei, he's so tarud, he's so preoccupied, that he cannot receive the summons. The Gemara now sets up two different dinim. There's one din about the hazmona itself, and there's another din about the zman hazmona, meaning when does he have to actually show up in Bezdin. So the Gemara says the following: that which Rabbi Yehuda excluded the months of Nisan and Tishrei, that's only as far as setting up the meeting or the court case during those months. We can't expect him to comply with the wish of Bezdin to show up in Nisan or in Tishrei for a court case that might take him out of, you know, out of his important asakim during those 2 months of the year when he makes enough money or he prepares for making money for the whole year round. But it doesn't mean that he's so torah that we can't hand him a summons. Again, the date for the summons will be in Iyar. The date for the summons will be in Cheshvan. But we can hand him the summons. But not so in the case of Erev Shabbos. And we'll have to see about Erev Yontif. He says the following: Aval mi Nisan libasar yomei de Nisan or bi yomei de Tishrei libasar Tishrei. Can we subpoena him to court during these 2 months of Nisan and Tishrei to show up for a din that's going to take place in Iyar or in Cheshvan? That we can do. Kavinon. We will determine that after Nisan or after Tishrei, there's a kvius zman, there's a set day for the court case. But Mimale Shabsa, let's say we want to deliver a summons on Friday, Libasar Mali Shabsa, so that the following Monday he'll show up in court, Lo Kavinon. We cannot set up a date until he receives the summons. And he cannot receive the summons on Erev Shabbos, meaning Erev Shabbos is not only excluded from a calendar date for establishing the court case, but it's even excluded for delivering the hazmona, the summons. My taima, why is that on Erev Shabbos we cannot invite him for a din? We call it in Hebrew today diyun after Shabbos. De'avidite divshabsa torut. He's totally Torah in avidite de Shabbos, in preparing all the avodos for Shabbos. Like the Torah says in Parashas Bishalach, it says, V'achinu es asher yaviru. On Yom HaShishi, he's so totally Torah And there are many halachas in Shas which establish that the dinim change on Erev Shabbos. Erev Shabbos has its own status because of a person's total obsession and preoccupation with preparing for Shabbos, then it's mufka, it's excluded Erev Shabbos even from delivering a hazman. So here there's a whole discussion here about Erev Yontif, why the Gemara didn't mention Erev Yontif over here. Some say that Kolshkein, and how much more so if he's Torah on Erev Shabbos, how much more so he's Torah on Erev Yontif. Others say that on Erev Yontif you don't have to prepare that much because a lot could be prepared on Yontif itself, like a lot of the cooking and the baking and so forth and so on. Omar Rav Nachman, lo yahavinon zimna lo lebnei kala bekala v'lo lebnei rigla berigla. Now we're talking about drashos. What do I mean by drashos? A lot of halachas were established to guarantee that the people would show up for the drush of the Rav. And that would be a weekly drusha on Shabbos and 30 days before each regel. Halavai, they should reinstitute this, by the way. Maybe more people would show up for the drusha. But in any event, back in the day, these were very strict halachas. So the Gemara wants to know what happens if a person wants to show up at the drasha and now you're going to deliver him a summons and he's very preoccupied. You know, he has to show up, he has to, you know, be there and free for the Shliach Beis Din to deliver him the summons and tell him that he has to, notify him that he has to show up in Beis Din. So Rav Nachman says, we do not deliver such a summons to those who show up for the drasha on Shabbos. I was wondering why this is mutter in general. Forget about the drasha of Shabbos. We have halacha medabru davar. You know, we don't do things on Shabbos and speak about things that are shayach to chol. So for some reason, Rav Nachman is not bothered by that. He doesn't think that it's a violation of medabru davar. Maybe he holds that tzedek tirdof, that what's ever necessary for justice, is permissible on Shabbos. Again, we can't write things, but we can speak about things. Now, it seems that Rav Nachman is talking about the B'nai Kala, or the B'nai Rigla. The B'nai Kala are those who actually show up for the drasha. Now, let's say there's an individual who, for whatever reason, he doesn't show up for the drasha. He doesn't come. You know, there's a famous story about the city of Kelm, you know, back in Poland about 100 years ago, that they put up signs that Rabbeinu Yonah, who was gone for about 8 centuries, was showing up to give a drasha. So everybody in the city of Kelm showed up. Not one person was missing. Because who wouldn't want to come to the drasha of Rabbeinu Yonah? Okay, but for Berzon's drasha, it's not the same. You know what I'm saying? Even for Rabbi Meis's drasha, it's not the same. Okay. So maybe we should, if we could falsify a drop, you know, put up the Pashkevillas that Rabbeinu Yonah is showing up. Maybe that would... Anyway... So ki hava also l'kami de Rav Nachman, and when they came, let's say now we're talking about the how do you call it in English? The tovea is called the plaintiff. Excellent. Okay, I'm always trying to translate that word. So when the plaintiff shows up in front of Rav Nachman, and he says that, okay, it's the days of drasha, but I still want you to summon this person into court. Amar lehu, so Rav Nachman says, v'chile didchu knufaychu, you think that because the Jews are gathered together, therefore gives you the opportunity to, through the arm of Beis Din, to summon this person to court. That's called lididchu, as if they gathered together for your purposes, to achieve your goal. But rather, no. They came together for a different purpose, and they're totally dedicated to that goal, and that is to hear the drasha. And after all this, and we were very excited about this, because we felt, wow, you know, we want to defend the ability of the Jew to go to a drasha, and therefore we exempt him from any sort of summons to Beis Din. The Gemara drops the whole business. And the Gemara says, "Why, in already an hour time, people took advantage of this opportunity. All of a sudden, everybody shows up at the drasha, all the Ramayim, all those swindlers who don't want to get summoned into Beis Din, they all run to hear the drasha." So, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for Aliyah. and different types of people come in Aliyah. But here, the reason why this guy shows up at the drasha is because he belongs to that category of swindlers called the Ramayim. And they come into the city, they look here, they look there, they know that somebody's going to catch them from Beis Din and force them, you know, to accept the summons. So what do? They roll into the Beis Medrash, you know, Mi'im Mizbechi, they're holding on to the Mizbeach. They come to hear the Drasha. It's Chayshinan. Therefore, we have no compunctions and no compassion on anyone who's going to the drasha. We no longer know why a person, what motivates a person to show up to the drasha. He might be showing up to the drasha just because he's a swindler. And I have no doubt that according to this comment of the Gemara, the Darshanim would speak about having very strict, how should I say, dedication to the laws of morality and having cleanliness with regard to money matters, because they knew who their clientele was.
Maybe if they don't come, they haven't come to Shema.
Did I put a T down over there? Yeah.
Maybe.
So maybe
it would turn out all right in the end. We should let them come
if they hear the drasha, you know. That's what they say, that there was a town down south in America, I don't remember what town it was, where they were chicken thieves. They were known to be chicken thieves, and the preacher, the pastor, you know, the non-Jewish pastor, used to give fire and brimstone every Sunday, you know, in the church about the terrible, immoral thing about stealing. You know, stealing is a terrible avera, and the people in the audience would go rah rah rah. You know, these are the thieves. And then one time, something was strange. He got up and he spoke about chicken thieves, and all of a sudden, everybody walked out. As long as he's talking about Gzela, about thieves, that was okay. But once he mentioned the chickens, that they couldn't tolerate. Now, we go back to the Mishnah at the beginning of our chapter here, which is on Kuf Yud Aleph Amin Beis. And the Mishnah concludes that in the case of Yarshim, who inherited stolen goods, it says, Imhoya Dover Sheyesh Bo Achrayus, which means karka, is Chayav L'Shalem. Now, why is it that if the Yarshim inherited what's called metaltalin and movables, then they could claim, well, we don't have to return this because we didn't steal it. But yet, in the case where they inherited stolen real estate, that they do have to replace, they do have to return and pay back the nigzal. So the Gemara assumes, you may recall this, that this is because of kibud av. Now, what does that mean by kibud av? It's a terrible humiliation when the Yarshim are holding on to something which the public knows is stolen goods that they inherited from their fathers. Everyone's saying terrible things about their father because why are they enjoying the benefit of these stolen goods that they inherited from their father? Their father was a no good gazlan. So therefore, for the sake of kibud av, to quiet down this terrible murmuring against their father, if it's public in nature, everybody knows about that piece of property, that piece of real estate that it's stolen, because karka is always considered, you know, real estate is always considered something that's stable and everybody knows about it, then they have to return it. What about other objects that were stolen and they have a public element to them, even though they're not what we call davar sheyesh bo achrayus, they're not technically karka? Is Masnile, we have a brisa, Rebbe l'Reb Shimon, in which Rebbe told his son, Rebbe Shimon, lo davar sheyesh bo achrayus mamish. The Mishnah is not to be limited in a literal translation to karka, el afilu, even something that's technically movable. It's not yesh bo achrayus, it's ein bo achrayus. And he gives the following examples, afilu para v'choresh ba, chamar u'mechamar achrov. So we're talking about work animals that were stolen in this case, inherited by the children of the gazlan, chayovim lahachzir. Here too they have to return the object, mipnei kvod avim, because of this terrible gnai, this terrible humiliation to their father, because everybody sees, look, they're doing the work out in the fields with a stolen cow. You know, in those days, if they didn't have an ox, they would thresh. Not thresh, plow, I guess you'd say, plow with a cow. Or, for example, when they had to carry a heavy burden, they would put it on the top of this beast, on this mule, and it would carry it. That's called mechamer. You have to know that on Shabbos, there's a lav, a special Iser lav of mechamer achar behemto. In any event, this is something that's public in nature, and therefore, even though it's not technically yesh bo achrayus, nevertheless, the same law kicks in. That's what Rebbe taught his son. Boy minei Rav Kahana mi Rav, how far are you willing to go? Mita umesiv oleh. What about if he has a couch and he reclines on the couch in the privacy of his own living room? Now, it could be that it's known that this couch was stolen, but nobody sees the Yarshim, unless you're invited in as a guest, laying down and enjoying the benefit of this couch. Or Shulchan V'Ochalav, he stole a table, his father, and now the Yarshim, the inherited, the heirs, are using this table in order to eat their dinner, but only in the confines of the dining room. Should we assume in this case that since it's only used inside, within the confines of the four walls of the home, therefore there's no gnai, there's no humiliation to the father? Or do we say no? People come into the house, you know, they invite people into the house, maybe they're big machnisei orchim, they're doing tshuva for their father, and people see, wow, that couch, that's a stolen couch. Again, I don't know today, in our sociological society, I don't know exactly what makes this couch mefursam, you know, that everybody knows it's a stolen couch. I don't know. I'm not sure how that works. Anybody have any ideas? I mean, to me, all the tables look the same, but maybe back in the day, they didn't have such manufacturing.
Yeah, but you can have other objects of art.
So I would say that objects of art, I would say, should come under this category of well, it's hard to put it under the category of para, because where does he keep the art? He keeps it in his living room. You know what I mean? He's not public. So it would probably come under this case. So David is pointing out that maybe in our society, instead of raising this question of kahana in the case of a table, because again, there are different tables. You know, you can go to Italy, you know, if you go to a furniture fair in Milano, you'll see 50,000 different tables. Every artist, every designer comes up with his own idea for a table, and certainly for a couch. I don't know if you ever went shopping for a couch. It's like, you know, you could spend a day, you know, trying to declare which couch you want to buy, you know, because there are 50 different variables, and of course, cost is a variable. But maybe in the case of artwork, you know, if you have something that's golden, you know, a golden piece of art, like a woman in gold, if you know what I mean, you know, then anybody would know what that art, you know, if it's stolen, looted art, you know. Amalo, so what was the response of Rav to Rav Kahana? Tein l'chacham v'yechkam ot. He quotes a verse in Mishlei. And that verse in Mishlei literally means when you speak to a wise person, he knows how to extend it and apply it to a wider scope. And it seems that what Rav was answering Rav Kahana, the way I understand it, is that even the case of Mita v'Shulchan have the same status as a cow and a mule. Even though Rebbe doesn't speak that out explicitly, but I think he's implying that they, the Yarshim, have to return this because there will be gnai, and even for a suffek gnai, we have to be very careful. Lamaisa, I'll tell you the truth. There may be another variable here. There is vested interest on the agenda, so to speak, of the halach is to force the yarshim to return it, because again, all this concern is about the gnai of the father. But above and beyond that, what about the nigzal? You know, the person who, from whom this was stolen, why shouldn't he get back his stolen property? Again, technically, according to the letter of the law, he doesn't have rights to get it back, right? We discussed the whole sugi of Yarshim Kilukuchos Davi, and therefore the Kona B'yeush of Bishini Rishus, and so forth and so on. But nevertheless, you know, fairness would require that we return it. So if you add to that a suffix that maybe it'll be a Gnai Lavim, so you have a double whammy here, you know, not only Gzela, but also Kibbut Avaim, then certainly we should be mach. Right, now we begin a Mishnah. Now, I have to introduce this Mishnah with my favorite Rishon, and that's the Rambam. The Rambam writes in Perek Hei Milchus Gzela, Asur Liknos Dover Gozel Minagazlan. If you know that someone is selling you stolen goods, what's the word for that in English? No? Offense, right? Very good. Offense. If you know that this is stolen goods, you're not allowed to buy it. And the Rambam seems to assume that that's an Issa Doraisa, because listen to the Rambam. He says, Kola Osa Dover Zef, a person buys stolen goods, Hareu Mechazek Yedei Ovre Avera, he's encouraging the thief to steal, the Over Al Vilifnei Iver Lo Site Miksha. He quotes a pasuk in Parashas Kedoshim, which tells you that you cannot abet a criminal. And here you're certainly setting it up and enticing him, almost facilitating his theft, because he knows that if no one's going to buy this goods, what does he gain by it? You know, especially like in the case of art that you mentioned, you steal a piece of art. So somebody steals a Rembrandt. What good is it going to do? He can hang up the Rembrandt somewhere in his house, but no one's going to pay him for it. Because as soon as he goes public, they're going to know that it's a stolen good. In any way, the Rambam seems to apply a Doraisa halacha for someone who buys stolen goods. Now, our Mishnah is going to discuss another case of someone who gets benefit, actually two cases of people who get benefit from stolen goods. And one case is an ani, a poor person who receives charity from a stolen chest, money that was stolen. And the other is a person who goes to a money changer, and there's reason to believe that the money in the money changer, let's say, for example, he has a sela and he wants to convert it into prutos. Let's say a sela is a silver coin, but he needs copper coins, so he goes to a money changer. If for some reason, that's what we're going to discuss in our Mishnah, the assumption is that the money that's being changed over here, that's being exchanged, is stolen money. Hopefully that's not true for any of the change places in our area, right? But if you want to do this, what's called lifrot is milashim pruta, because the copper coins are called prutos, and you need the smaller coins, so you want to give a larger coin for the sake of changing it into smaller coins. So the Mishnah says, ein partin, that there are two cases where you're not allowed to do that, because you assume that the prutos that you are being given in exchange for your sela are stolen prutos. And again, according to the Rambam, if you're getting stolen goods, it would seem that you're violating an Issa Doraisa. And that's called Lifnei Iver Lo Site Miksha. Now, what are the two cases where we assume that the money changer is giving you stolen money? Number one is lo mitevas hamochsin, and number two is lo mikis shel gabon. Now we have to understand before we even blink that this word gabon is not what we think it means. It doesn't mean the gabon in the shul. You know, those gabon in Mirz Hashem are the most holy, you know, the most holy people and the most righteous and moral people. These gabon are gaboy hamelech. They serve for the king. Well, maybe they don't serve for the king, we'll have to see. But in any event, who are these mochsin? So the mochsin and the gaboyim were both tax collectors. What's the difference between mochsin and gaboyim? They're two different forms or types of tax collectors. So mochsin, which we use today in modern Hebrew the same word meches, those are duty charges on merchandise. Let's say, for example, if I own merchandise, then the state can determine that I have to pay a tax for that merchandise that I own. And there were those who were appointed by the king, by the government, to collect this meches. And for some reason, which we're going to explain in just a minute, the monies that were collected by the mochsin are assumed to be stolen. Now, the Rambam is going to argue that there's a big chiddush here. We don't know that there's stolen money, and we certainly don't know that the prutos that he's going to give me when I exchange my sela for prutos, that pruta itself was stolen. But there is a logical plausibility that maybe it was stolen. And therefore, the Rambam would apply the principle of safek. Don't take any chances. Don't expose yourself to the vulnerability of being nana, of being enjoying the stolen goods. Because in the case of mochsin, there's a lot of stuff that's in the teva is like the treasury chest of these mochsin, that's in fact stolen, it's illegal. Then we have the case of kis shel gabon. Kishal Gaboyim, this is a different type of a tax. This is also a tax collector. But right now, before we get a little bit more complicated, we're going to assume on a simple level, superficially, that these are taxes that are standard taxes that don't have to do with a duty tax on a particular piece of merchandise, but these are the taxes that you pay. Let's say you pay 20% of your income for an annual tax, and it's collected by the gabbai. Oh, so what's the problem? Why do we assume that in this teva shel mochsin or kis shel gabbaim, stolen money? And to such an extent that not only are you enjoined from taking change, but also a note l'mam stocker. If you're an ani, you don't get your charity money from those sources. And this, by the way, is a fascinating contemporary issue about whether or not you could receive stocker money from places of questionable origin. Very contemporary issue. There are a lot of donations that come, big monies, from very questionable sources. My father used to say that when he was a child, there was a phrase that when you work as a waiter in a hotel and you basically the money you make is really tips, then the racketeers, they were the biggest tippers. Mm-hmm. Easy come, easy go. But in any event, the question is, why do we assume that in these two cases of tax collectors, the money is stolen? So here we have Rashi and the Rashba. And what we have here is the following, that the king sometimes goes too far. Now let's explain. I'm not sure that they had a full-fledged democracy back at the time of the Gemara, but let's call it a quasi-democracy. What do I mean? That the people understood that taxes had to be collected, and there was a legal method by which taxes had to be collected. And they understood that. But there were certain cases that came up throughout history in which the king would by far overstep his bounds. Maybe he wanted to buy 1,000 pairs of shoes, I don't know what. And he would tax above the law. In other words, the law did not give him rights for that taxation. And in such a case, says the Rashba, Hitil HaMelech Shalo Kidin El Alpi Ritzono Levat. The king had a desire on his own to collect enormous sums of money to fill up his own treasury. In such a case, that's stolen money. There's no legal justification for the king through the arm of the mochsin to fill his treasury with this money. And this is going to lead us to a major sugya that we're about to learn called Dina de Malchusa Dina, which means that the law of the land is recognized halachically as valid, but up until certain limitations. And there are certain situations in which if the king oversteps his bounds, that law is not considered valid, it's not recognized, and therefore the monies he is collecting are considered stolen monies.
Stolen or gazul?
In Hebrew I would say gazul, in English stolen. I know what you want to use a different word?
Stolen is like a galu, but it means without da'at.
Correct, there's no das, because what we do is we force a person to give that money over to the king.
But he knows who he gave it to.
Oh, so that's going to raise an issue of what's called yeush, meaning that even if the king was illegally imposing these taxes, is there yeush? Meaning, does the average citizen realize he's in a no-win situation, he has no choice, and he's got to pay up these taxes, otherwise he'll get expelled from the country, maybe he'll be prosecuted, I don't know what they'll do to him, I don't want to even think. And therefore, that should generate what's called yeush. Now, here we have to remember, which is ages ago, on Daf Samach Vav, we learned the sugya machlok shin Rav Shimon and the Chachamim about stam gzela, whether it is yeush or it's not. So, Rav Shimon is of the opinion that stam yeush is stam gzela is considered yeush bailam, and how much more so in this case, where the government, through the arm of the king, through this meches guy, is collecting monies. We should certainly assume that there's yeush. Now, if there's Yeush, then the din is that the Gazan is Kona B'Yeush. So if this Meches guy, representing the government, is stealing money, Shalom Kedin, but nevertheless, since the giver, in this case the rank and file citizen, knows that he has no recourse to get the money back, that creates what? Yeush. And once it's Yeush, then there's a kinyan on the part of the Gazlan, and there was certainly Shini Rishus because it went from my pocket to the treasury of the king. So with Yeush plus Shini Rishus, the Gazlan was Kona, and therefore the money is no longer Gazel. Like, for example, the Gemara says in the third parak of Brachos that if you have Hadassim that were cut illegally by Gazlanim and you buy them, then if you were Kona with both Yeush and Shini Rishus, then you could be Yotzei the mitzvah of Lachem. Why? Because you purchased it for, and the Gazan was Kona it. So the Chachamim here are in trouble, Lachor, in this mission, because the Chachamim hold that is. No, I'm sorry, just the opposite. Rav Shimon is in trouble, right? Because according to Chachamim, there was no Yeush here. Because Tam Gzela is Leka Yeush. And therefore, you are benefiting from stolen goods if you receive money from the Tevas HaMochsin. But according to Rav Shimon, who says Tam Yeush, then why would there be any problem of taking this money? It's already past the level of Kinyan Al Yidei HaGazlan. He was already coded with Yeush. So it's unbelievable that Tosus here, Dibra Maskel Ein, one line and a half up from the bottom, he says, Mishum de Dover Megunahu. Do you have those words? And basically what he's saying is that we're not talking about an Isur Doraisa. This is not something here, this Mishum de Dover Megunahu. If you have a chance, you go through the Tosus here. But in any event, what he means is that the Rabbanon made a takana here, call it a siag, in which they want to keep us far away from benefiting from Gzela. And even in a case where technically we're not benefiting from Gzela, because the Gazan was Kona, according to Rav Shimon, because Stam Gzela Yeish Bailam. Nevertheless, it's a Dover Maguna. So I began the discussion of this Mishnah with the Rambam. The Rambam says that to buy or to enjoy the benefit of stolen goods is a Doraisa of Lifnei Iver. Elo, what the chiddush of our mission is that this is only a suffek, and even though it's only a suffek, nevertheless the Torah prohibits it. No, now we're talking in the context of Tosfos about a Dover Maguna, about something which is instituted and established by the Chachamim. It's not a Doraisa at all. And even the Rama might agree in this case that it's not Doraisa. Why? Because it's after Yeush. However, I would argue that the Rambam is not the same as Tosfos. Why? Because the Rambam invokes the Issa Doraisa of Lifnei Iver, meaning what motivates the Gazlan to steal? The fact that he knows that he can sell his goods and make a profit on his theft. If that be the case, then we're not talking about a Dover Maguna. I couldn't care less whether or not the Gazlan technically acquired ownership on the stolen goods through Yeish and Shina Rishus. At the end of the day, it boils down to Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michsha. You're making it valuable or worth his while for him to steal. That's a violation of a Doraisa. Now, I admit that maybe this case of Muchsin is a suffek. I can't tell you that, you know, if he would charge him 10%, that would be legal, but he charged him 50%. You know, so the discrepancy, the balance between 10 and the increment between 10 and 50 is illegal. So I can't tell you that every last pruta in the Tevash Muxin is stolen, but nevertheless, Safek Doraisa L'chumra. Because at the end of the day, you're encouraging Gzela. So I don't know. But in any event, Tosus for sure is of the opinion that we're not dealing with an Issa Doraisa here, but rather with an Issa Dirabon. The Rush, right here in Perek Asiri and Siman Tes, says explicitly that this is only Dirabonon. And I'll read to you the language of the Rush. He quotes it in the footnote. He says that even according to the Chachamim, Vadai, Yesh Kan Yesh. Even the Chachamim would agree that there's certainly Yesh. And Tosfos only said that we have to introduce Dover Meguna to justify the Shita of Reb Shimon, who holds that there is no Yesh. But he says everybody agrees that there's Yesh. Why? Because who's going to get it back from the government? Ela hu geder usyag sha'omru Chachamim shlo likach mihem. that we shouldn't take the monies from the muhsin, from the teva shel muhsin. It's certainly a geder and a siyah. We see clearly that the rush is outspoken that we're dealing not with an isa d'oraisa, but rather with an isa d'rabbana. And I'll tell you the honest truth, I'm going to say something that's very questionable. But libi omerli, my heart tells me that if somebody went ahead and he did this thing, and he shouldn't have done it, and he has the money in his pocket, or if he's an ani and now he needs that money to support his family, I would say b'dieved, he's allowed to enjoy the benefits of the mos. Because this is only a dover maguna, you know, it's only a minog that the chachamim established in the lashon of the rush as a siag and a geder. Okay, so he violated the siag and the geder, and he took money from the teva shel muhsin. Okay, give him patch for that, but it doesn't mean that we have to enjoin him and prohibit him from enjoying anything else. I will note whom he told beso. The Mishnah concludes omen ashuk, but it doesn't mean that every coin in the pocket of the tax collector is considered to be gzela. It's only from the kiss. But if you meet him in the shuk and he gives you money, or you take money from his house, then we don't have to assume that it's stolen. It's stolen only in that special table of the government. Okay, man. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Thank you so much.
Okay, so have a good week. Shabbat, we'll be opposed.